Hi, everyone. This is Catherine Adams
and Elizabeth Wallace, and you're listening to Binary System Podcast number 431. And at time this episode drops, it is Halloween.
Yay! Ooh, I love the spooky season. I will probably be spending the evening giving out candy and watching scary movies.
Speaking of which, I understand you saw something for the first time last night.
I finally watched Exorcist 3, and I am really glad I did. And also, I agree with all the commentary online. It is like a super strong first two-thirds of the movie, and then the last third where they have to shoehorn in the exorcist. I mean, it's not terrible, but you can tell that it's not up to the level of the rest of the movie.
Right, yeah, and I've been looking at the IMDb trivia, and that is exactly what happened. So William Blatty wrote the book Legion, and he wanted to film it as Legion, but the producers came in and said, no, it needs to be Exorcist 3, even though Exorcist 2 was terrible, and the author hated that movie because it was so terrible. But he went with it, and then, son of a gun, at the end of production, they realized that they had the title Exorcist with no exorcism in the movie, so they added an exorcism. And it sounds like everybody involved was like, aw, they shouldn't have made him do that, but we tried to do our best.
Yeah, it was kind of obvious that it just didn't quite fit.
Well, there was no reason for the exorcist to show up at that particular moment other than to save the day because the plot required it.
Yeah, no, agreed.
Okay, now, what did you think of the jump scares in this one? Because there are two.
Yeah, okay, so there's one where you've got the nurse who's checking out some scary noises in one of the hospital rooms, and as she's leaning over, the patient who's in the bed suddenly jumps out at her because he's pissed off that she's woken him up and he's yelling at her. And it did, really, just startle the life out of me.
It really did. I mean, the other scare is more famous, but this one was just like out of freaking nowhere. And I felt like it took a couple years off my life there the first time I saw that. Now, the second one, though, was the one where you've been watching that nurse from far, far down the hallway, like adjusting some things, locking a door, talking with the security guard, whatever, and you're just sitting there, you're waiting. She leaves her room, walks across the hall, and this white robe figure comes after her with that gigantic set of shears. Yeah, that was a pretty good jump scare, too.
It wasn't just that it was a good jump scare. It was such a cool visual. I mean, it's just like, they're just sailing after her just with that knife held straight out in front of it. It looks so cool. And I was not expecting it at all. Because up to that point, I don't know, it didn't really, the movie hadn't really had a lot of like the traditional like horror movie visuals. I think that was where the tone of the movie just changed just a little bit.
I feel like that would make a great, that would make a fantastic Halloween costume, and only like a certain set of the population would know what you were dressed as if you went with all of those white robes and that ridiculous looking set of like murder shears that they're holding.
Yeah. You know what's something else I liked in this movie? Just more on a, I guess more on a political level.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the main cast is pretty white, which is totally fine and everything. But man, the background cast, there are so many characters, including characters with speaking roles that are either Asian or African-American, like a really good mix. And I felt like somebody made a deliberate choice to be like, let's make sure this thing isn't quite so white, you know? I liked it. I thought it was great.
And even George C. Scott's character ranting at one of his subordinates about how he was both racist and freaking clueless about everything. I like that. Also liked how he was honestly traumatized by that poor kid, Thomas, getting murdered and seeing him in the dream and saying, I'm sorry you got murdered, Thomas. I miss you. And I thought, aw, that's so nice. Now, that dream was awesome. Any kind of dream imagery that gets that level of surreality is just perfect. And did you know that was actually Samuel L. Jackson in that scene? But they dubbed over his voice for some reason. Weird.
Yeah, I have no idea why. But yeah, I'm not even sure he's credited, to be honest. But what's more weird, isn't that the same dream sequence where suddenly Fabio,
because he's an angel. Because why not?
I guess that's fine. I had to back up the screen. I'm like, there's motherfucking Fabio there. My God. There we go.
And the way it ended, too, with like the rapid fire clock ticking and all the images. And then George C. Scott's character's friend, Father Dyer, getting just like thrashed back and forth and then wake up. And then suddenly you see outside the house, and George C. Scott, you hear him answer the phone and hello, and long pause, what are you telling me? And I thought, oh my God, that gave me chills. I love that. Perfect delivery.
Because I loved, they really did set up his friendship with the priest. Like, you know, having lunch together, and that's fine. And the fact that they were each telling their friends, like the cop is saying, I'm there to cheer up the priest. And the priest is telling his friends, I'm there to cheer up the cop. They're obviously there to cheer up each other. But, you know, they just had a really good kind of rapport in the diner. But then when the priest ends up going to the hospital and George C. Scott goes to visit him, and you see outside the door of the hospital, George C. Scott goes running up the stairs and he's out of breath and he like stops and composes himself and he walks in the room with this nonchalant, so what's this nonsense? You know, like he doesn't care at all, but you got to see him putting that face on, and it was a lovely little subtle bit of acting there.
I was not expecting the comedic moments in this movie between George C. Scott and I believe the actor's name is Ed Flanders, which I have to wonder if Ned Flanders from The Simpsons was at least partially inspired by this guy. I mean, it seems like too much of a coincidence that it's Ed Flanders playing a priest, but anyway.
Yeah. Maybe. But, though all I know him from is I know him from the old guy from St. Elsewhere.
That's when
I
saw right.
Him. I was like, that's the old guy from St. Elsewhere. I'm sorry.
But I mean, just the funny bits out of nowhere in that hospital scene. You know, at one point, this nurse is just like standing right outside the door and she says something like, oh, screw this guy. And just like flashes back to Father Dyer. Very restful in here. Just the comedic beats were done so well in that entire scene.
Yeah, seriously. I want to get credit. I'm just looking at my notes right now. I want credit for the fact that they're kind of in like the insane ward and they're going past a bunch of people in there. And I see this one older woman and I was like, oh, I know her. Oh, she's going to be important later because she's a big actress and no way she's in here just for no reason. I'll just background color. It's the old woman from the Stargate movie is where I recognized
her. Oh, no kidding. Oh, I did not catch that. Yes, credit to you for catching that.
Yay. But yeah, she definitely came by later on. I was like, called it. She's important. So she was the one who ended up breaking out of the insane asylum and posing as a nurse when she went to go visit his family.
Yeah, and I was rather surprised the first time I saw this movie. I thought for sure the daughter character was going to lose her head at that moment, but she gets
absolutely
dragged away literally at the last second. I watched that and I'm like, well, kudos to the mother-in-law character who actually has agency in that scene and rescues her granddaughter because she was just played as kind of like the shrewish sort of comedic person in the background. But I'm like, yeah, you go.
Yeah, seriously. I also want to go ahead and say for the record, all this time that you've been saying Brad Dourif does an amazing job. And I'm like, yeah. And then he shows up. I'm like, oh, that's Brad Dourif. I know him as the guy, the psychic from X-Files. Also the doctor from, not Tombstone. What the hell?
Oh, Deadwood. Yes, from Deadwood.
Deadwood. Yes, exactly. Yeah, he's amazing in this. He's so scary. Wow.
He is the reason why I've seen this movie multiple times now, just to watch his scenes, because he's just frightening and intense. But then he'll just stop and like try to be, you know, sort of polite, whatever, with this menace hiding underneath it. And it's so good. And then, of course, adding in the voice effects that they're doing, it's not overdone. I think they did the perfect touch. Nope. I think some people would probably say that it's a little clunky, but I'm just like, no, give me more of this. It's great.
Speaking of give me more of this, at one point there's a woman in the insane asylum, I guess, and she's crawling on the ceiling, and it really doesn't, it doesn't need to be there technically, but I saw it and I was like, yes, if you're going to have an Exorcist movie, somebody needs to be climbing on the ceiling at some point.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, it was just, I mean, the story itself is, it turns out that Father Karras, who died at the end of The Exorcist, hell was so angry that he drove a demon out of the little girl from the first movie that they decided to punish him by having him be possessed by the soul of someone who was put to death for being a serial killer. So,
sure.
And at the same time, once this serial killer was able to like reconstruct Father Karras's brain, which was damaged obviously from dying, he was able to possess other people to go out and commit these murders, which is why you had serial killings happening with the same MO but different fingerprints. And yet Father Karras's soul was both in his body and able to see the people that these other people, the serial killer, was possessing, murdered. I don't know any of it, but it all works for me anyway.
Yeah, I'm perfectly fine with it. I did feel like towards the end, I guess more of the padding thing. You know, and of course, it goes back and forth between you're seeing Father Karras and then you're seeing Brad Dourif, who's actually possessing him. And one of Brad Dourif's last little rants that he goes on, did you feel like it was maybe going on just a little too long?
Maybe a tiny bit. I mean, there's several moments when he starts ranting, and some of them work better than others. But yeah, when he comes out of it at one point, it's like, oh, forgive me, was I ranting? And then talking about the doctor that he had been threatening into helping him and into bringing George C. Scott's character to him. He was entertainingly quirky. I mean, the fact that he was chain smoking, literally lighting one cigarette off the end of the other, and then sitting there for like at least 20 seconds or so, tamping out the other cigarette to make sure it's out. And George C. Scott is kind of looking at him, okay.
Yeah, but I've got that in my notes. It's like, oh, this guy's literally going through a thing.
He is going through a thing. So, of course, he commits suicide because he can't take the pressure. And Brad Dourif's character talks about how weak he was, but he helped me a lot. Will there be a funeral? I'd like to attend. And just how he delivers all of his lines was so good.
It really was. Yeah, I feel like I'm really jumping around kind of randomly here because I just had all of these like notes that I was writing at the time when I spotted it. But speaking of people who died or didn't die, or I don't know, the exorcist who comes in, which we've already talked about, is just kind of like, who's this guy? What is he supposed to be doing? Whatever. Oh, at one point, he's stuck to the wall or stuck to the ground or something, and he moves his head and his flesh is stuck to the ground and it peels away from his skull. And I'm like, that is probably the most brutally descriptive effect that they have in that entire movie. Yeah, that's almost too far for me.
It's almost too far because not only was his scalp and skin peeling away, but his like skull was peeling away from his brain. It's just like, oh my God, that's awful. But I don't know that he actually survives that. I think he like revives briefly to save the day and then they don't really indicate him afterwards. But his scenes were literally filmed after everything else was done because they needed an exorcist and they were trying to make it not look like it was coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, and I guess they would put an effect like that in just to make sure that everybody knew. It's like, hey, this is the third act of a horror movie. Something scary has to happen. Because previously, a lot of the stuff that you see is really understated. Very beginning of the movie when there'd been a murder and all you see is the tail edge of a slowly moving puddle of blood, which was really super effective. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when George C. Scott goes to find his friend, of course, who's been killed, you don't see the body, but you see George C. Scott's reaction to it. And he's so good. Saying George C. Scott is a great actor, it's like, well, it's a piece of obvious, and the sky is also blue. But no, seriously, he's a really good actor who's obviously, I'm sure on some level he had to have been aware that maybe this movie wasn't turning out to be worth his time, but he certainly didn't phone anything in.
No, he didn't. He was great in all of it. He would lose his temper at people to get them to shut up because they're all talking at once. And you're like, oh, yeah. When George C. Scott tells everyone to stop talking, you stop talking. Any scenes that he had, like he punched Brad Dourif's character at one point and the nurse goes to check on him and you hear her shouting from off camera, his damn nose is broken. But then, then she bandages George C. Scott's knuckles and she's like, she's a bitchy character, but she's just kind of straightforward shooting for the hip. And just a great scene, really fun to watch.
Yeah, this is a surprisingly good movie. And if you're really allergic to gore, there's not that much, though. Seriously, that brain peeling scene is like, yikes. But you get a lot of notice that it's about to happen because you start to see him pull away. And at that point, if you don't like gore, go ahead and close your eyes. The rest of the movie, not so much. Really only those two jump scares and just good writing and a good plot, aside from, you know, towards the end when maybe it went off the rails just a little bit, but that's fine. But I thought the ending was really still good and tragic and kind of poignant.
And the scenes of Father Karras rising up from hell at one point, from a hole that just appeared in the ground, that was kind of unsettling too. But,
oh, gracious. Ugh. Yeah, a lot of good stuff going on there.
And I do want to reiterate, not only do you not need to watch The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, I'd recommend against it. I say you should like look up Red Letter Media Exorcist 2. And it'll be, it's like they did three movies that episode. I think it's the last one. They will show clips and they will talk about it and the whole plot and everything. And you will see it and go, ah, I do not need to watch this movie because it looks dreadful.
Yeah, everybody says it's horrible. It's just really, which makes it more impressive that, you know, the third movie of a series ends up kind of improving. I mean, usually it's a pretty good trajectory down. Though I feel like there's somewhere I saw a chart that was rating the sequels of different movies. And it would show them in like bar graphs as to the first one is better, the second one is horrible, the third one is okay. And so I think it actually, we like to say that with the sequels, they just get worse as they go along. Not always.
Not always the case.
Is there anything else you want to say about Exorcist before we move on to the next thing?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I think the first movie obviously is a classic, but sometimes I think it's a victim of its own hype because they would market it as the scariest movie ever made. And then people like 30, 40 years down the road watch it again and they're laughing because it's, I mean, things were a little bit less scary in the movies back then. Nowadays, you've got torture porn and all that other stuff. So I think people have gotten a little jaded. But, you know, Exorcist 3, I think it's fun.
It is very fun. Okay, less fun, but something we should definitely mention. Catherine sent me a message the other day, and she said, okay, the bad news is Good Omens 3, the season, is not going to happen. The good news is they're going to do a 90-minute show to wrap everything up. So at least that's something.
Yep, and it's not going to involve Neil Gaiman because he is stepping away because he offered to do that to not distract from the production, probably to save the production. But, I mean, there's a lot of people that are just so distraught about this because Neil Gaiman is not denying that these relationships took place, but he's saying that they are all consensual. And it's just like, he's this wonderful writer who has just created the most magical things I've ever read or listened to, or, you know, with the Doctor Who and the Doctor's Wife watched. I mean, just stunning, stunning stuff. And then and then he does this, and it's just a creepy old man preying on people that was in his control or younger fans or whatever. And somebody on, I think it was on one of the comment sections about the news about Good Omens said he wrote Coraline and he wanted to tell his children that there are grown-ups out there that will give you things that you want, like toys and all the food that you want and play games and a magical place to stay, and they might not have your best interests at heart. So he knows the way that people can prey on younger people, and yet he did it anyway. So it's just so disappointing.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was talking to my friends Jada and Lisa this week as we were coming back. They had a book fair in North Park, which is very fun. I liked it. And I mentioned the Neil Gaiman thing, and they're both of their reactions are, what Neil Gaiman thing? What's happening? I've been hearing, because of course we're on Twitter and we're on Blue Sky, and not everybody is as terminally online as we are. But they had not heard one single thing. And I've been hearing that Neil Gaiman's PR company is fucking phenomenal because they have kept this out of the mainstream discourse. You're hearing about it if you're on social media, but main news organizations aren't really saying anything. So that is kind of fascinating to me and also pretty terrifying.
Yeah. And well, I just remember when he and his wife, Amanda, wasn't it, got divorced and there was some accusations of bad behavior flying around. And you're right, his PR team shut everything down. There was never any salacious details coming out. You really had this idea that Amanda was kind of high strung or high maintenance and left because she was a difficult person, which we've seen this happen so many times. It's not the man's problem for his behavior. It's the woman's problem for calling him out. So I just...
I don't know. I had heard that they had an open relationship, and my instinctive thought, because I don't know Amanda very well, I'm not as familiar with her music or all of her creations and everything. My first thought was, oh, I bet Amanda wants an open relationship and Neil is going on with it just to save the relationship. Chances are almost certainly not true. Nope. So, you know, no.
Wow.
Anyway, so at least we will get something to wrap up Aziraphale and Crowley's relationship, I hope.
Yes.
I hope it's halfway decent anyway.
I do too. So, only other thing we watched this week, Nathan and I watched the original Japanese movie Ringu, which is what the movie The Ring was based on.
Had you never watched? I've watched it. Have you never watched it before?
I've never seen it before, actually. And yeah, it is good, and I can see how it has inspired so much love from fans. I would love, here's a sci-fi idea, an app that allows you to temporarily erase your memory of having seen something. So A, you could watch something again for the first time, and B, you could watch the other version of it and see if you like it better. Because right now I feel like I like the first one, the American one that I saw, because I saw it first.
Right.
But I don't know how much of it is... The Japanese version has some cultural touchstones that maybe don't connect as well with me. The scary movie that everyone watched on the VHS in the American language version was scarier and more surreal and more thorough.
I do believe that. Yeah, I do believe that.
Nathan kind of wishes that the American version hadn't done that bit with the horse getting killed on the ferry. He didn't really think it added that much to the movie.
It's true. It does, you know, anytime they kill an animal in a movie, you tend to lose a lot of the audience. And I think they could have gotten away with not doing that. So,
But with, you know, the I cannot even think of his name. It's the actor. He was the father of the little girl, we think. We don't know for sure how she was. He was the one who commits suicide in the bathtub with all the electronic equipment.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
But that one bit when he's talking about, and the things that they shows you. And I just, you can really see the horror in his eyes about the images that this little girl was implanting on his brain and his wife's brain. Just, I didn't quite get that sense in the Japanese one. But I'll tell you what, in the American one, I can just see the producers watching the first cut of the film and seeing the bit when you have actors portraying that they've died of fright and them going, it's not scary enough. They need more makeup. And they come and bring it back. No, they need more makeup. We need more effects. So you get that ridiculously cartoony, like, face from everybody that's like, come on now. If that, you know, they talked about, they said it was a heart attack, but I've never seen anyone's face like that. Well, yeah, it's not even human anymore. I mean, people would be screaming to the rooftops about, what is this thing that's like morphing people's faces?
Yeah, every once in a while, the producers, I think, get a hand in there where they probably should. Or the directors, sometimes you're too close to your own work and you don't have anybody to tell you no. It's just like, dude, can we just take that down to like a 7, please?
Yep.
It's been a while since I've seen The Ring. That's another one I need to put on my watch list. I mean, we're talking like 6 or 7 years, I think, since I've seen The Ring. I should definitely watch that one.
Well, you know, I was talking about the movie X and then the sequel Pearl. In X, one of the main characters is played by the actor who plays Noah in The Ring. And I'm like, wow, I've not seen him in anything else other than those two movies.
Yeah, it's a thing that happens.
But he was good in both of them. I was really impressed. Although, I remember watching the American version of The Ring, and when, you know, Noah, he's the character, he's talking to his son and talking about why he and his mom aren't together. And, you know, him saying that, your mom and I, when we had you, we were really in little voices. You were young, mom told me. It's like, yeah, I wasn't ready to be a father. But really, when it comes to it, I don't want anybody else to be your dad either. And I'm like, aw, that's a terrible sentiment.
Yeah, no, that's really kind of awful. Sorry. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are going to think that, but you probably shouldn't put that on your kids.
You shouldn't put that on your kid. And also, I want to like be a dad to this little boy because I don't want anyone else taking on that particular role, not because I necessarily want to do it. Ugh, no, don't like that.
No, that kid, I mean, even without the events of the movie, that kid's going to need some therapy. So,
yes. Yeah. Well, I also liked how creepy the little boy was in the American version. They really didn't have anything like that in the Japanese version. The psychic stuff that obviously the little boy in the American version had, it didn't show up in Japanese.
Yeah, but I mean, just from the stunned expression on his face when he realizes what his mom has done, he's just like, why would you do that? And it's just so like, so horrible. Oh, I loved that I got to see that movie in the theater. Just the last few minutes of that movie with her coming out of the TV. I mean, she's climbing out of the TV and everybody is shrieking, and then she stands up and suddenly suddenly she's right in front of him and the whole audience just loses their goddamn minds. And it's just the best. I love it so much.
I did like in both versions, you have, you know, they've found the little girl and they're going to be able to give her a good burial and everybody goes home and like, why is the movie still going? It's like, that's when you start realizing, oh, something else is going to happen now.
I was about to say, we've seen a movie before. This means it's not done yet. Oh, no. But I guess on that note, that will wrap us up for the week. So make sure to check out pixelatedgeek.com for all the book reviews, the comic book reviews, the photo galleries. I actually did read they have one more volume of The Magic Order has started up, and I've read the first two issues of it, and it's actually pretty good. The previous two were, I don't know, something was wrong with the writing, I don't know, but now this seems to be like an interesting story and interesting magical tropes and people doing magical things because they don't have to obey the laws of reality, and I like all of that. So I will have a review of that up there. And Hugh has some movie reviews too. And Catherine has some book reviews. Of course, Laird Barron retweeted your review because I knew he would.
Yeah, I love how he phrased it. He said, thank you to Catherine Eddins for a very thorough review of my book. And I was like, yes, if it's a short story collection, I am going to be thorough. I'm going to list a little summary of every story because I don't want any of them to feel left out.
No, that's exactly right. He would wonder. He would be like, well, why didn't you talk about this story?
It's all of them. All the stories.
All that and more. PixelatedGeek.com. So next week we should have a Night Vale episode.
We will, yes. And we are just about, it's counting down a few more days to the Dragonfall Drawing Challenge on Instagram. Ooh. So I've got a list. I've got a post just about ready to go. So I will be sharing that with everybody. This is the first time I'm going to be doing all my own prompts. So we will see how this goes.
It's going to be so exciting. And by halfway through the month, we're going to be like, why do we do this to ourselves
every year? Ugh.
Every time. Anyway, one way or the other, we will talk to everybody in 1 week.
Talk to y'all later.